The Ryan Tubridy Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Centre Parks. Spot rare wildlife, explore the forest, and have endless adventures together.
Hello there and welcome to our weekly podcast. This is a compilation of our best interviews from the last week, all in one place. And so, to this week, on Monday we spoke to the youngest ever elected political representative in Northern Ireland, 18-year-old Antrim man Lewis Boyle. On Tuesday, Brendan Maher and Pauline Cullen spoke about their experience of becoming parents to two children with special needs. On Wednesday, Finbar Fury gave a touching tribute to the late, great Christy Dignam upon news of his passing. On Thursday, former FBI boss James Comey discussed how a fascinating career taking down some of America's biggest criminals as New York State Attorney led to writing his new crime novel, Central Park West. And on Friday, Meath native and West End star Killian Donnelly gave us a great insight into his life in musical theatre, from roles such as Phantom of the Opera to Les Mis, ahead of his upcoming appearance in Fun Home at the Gate Theatre. And that's it for this week. Hope you enjoy it. Thanks for listening. I want to go to our guest who's standing by on the phone this morning, who kind of, he's another one of these great young people that we've been talking to in the last couple of weeks about what they want to do and their dreams and their ambitions. He's 18 years old. He's from Antrim. His name is Lewis Boyle. Good morning, Lewis. Nice to talk to you.
Hello there. How are you?
Very well. You didn't do the Leaving Cert, of course. You did your A-levels. How did it go for you?
Well, hopefully they went all right, but I'm sure I'll find out on results day if they did.
I don't know if you know how intense the Leaving Cert is in terms of people's reaction to it and how we feel about it in the Republic of Ireland. What's the sort of pressure, A-levels wise, for people of your vintage?
Well, in Northern Ireland, I had to sit six exams. They're quite strenuous. Certainly quite a stressful time for everybody. Exams are stressful for everybody across the world, both north and south. But there's a great level of stress for people here in Northern Ireland as well for their A-levels.
Okay, so no, it's universal, exams, and young people. Okay, so did you study politics? I mean, I was watching the news the other evening with my youngest, who's 18, and she was saying, why don't we learn about the political parties and party systems in school here, which I think was a great question, because if you encourage people to learn about the parties, regardless of where you're coming from, left, right, centre, at least know who they are and what they are so that you can, you know, who you're voting for or who you might even run for office for. How do they teach politics when you're at school?
So at my school, the first module was the British political system in Westminster, and then it is the American political system. So it's the structures of government in both those. And then the other module is political ideology. So you have an understanding of liberalism, conservatism, socialism, stuff like that. But yeah. I do get your point. I think it's incredibly important that we are teaching people what the political parties stand for, because if we're putting them forward and we're saying, please go forward, vote for these people, they're going to make the decisions for you, it's good to know what the parties are standing for that you're going to vote for.
Now, you decided to run for the local elections recently at the age of 18, while still at school. Why? Yes. Simple question.
Well, absolutely. I wanted to run for local government because you can see things that aren't being done effectively. And you can, of course, lobby council from outside, but there's absolutely no better way to make positive change and actual impact on your community by getting involved in the decision making process. And I've got right in there in that process, and I can make changes that I see that need to be done and the other young people have seen. And additionally, not just limited to the young people, but for everybody across the DEA that I represent.
I see you were given a 50-50 chance of being elected. So I admire your chutzpah that you just said, yep, I'm going to throw the dice here. Where did that come from, that interest in politics and the confidence?
Well, I was always interested in politics. I mean, the first thing I remember politically was the Scottish independence referendum. Yeah. And I would have only been around 9 or 10 at the time, and I was just so interested in the entire process, what the Scottish wanted to do after independence, or if they didn't get independence, staying in the union. There was just something that was so fascinating towards me there, and I've always had that interest, and I was totally obsessed throughout the entire Brexit negotiation period. Yeah. Just learning about it, I couldn't learn enough about it, and I've always had that interest. So whenever I had an opportunity to step into politics, I immediately jumped at it.
And you're with the Alliance Party, which is kind of on the move, isn't it? It's on the ascendance in Northern Ireland.
It absolutely is. We've been undergoing a period called the Alliance Surge, where our number of elected representatives and our first preference votes has absolutely expanded massively. I mean, we've gone from being the distant fifth place party in Northern Ireland to now being firmly the third biggest party in Northern Irish politics. That's a massive leap that we've undergone. And all signs show that we're going to continue that growth, and I'm incredibly excited to be part of that.
And am I right in saying that to be First Minister or Deputy First Minister, it's either of the two main big parties, and that maybe the Alliance would like a little tilt at that, maybe to adjust the rules a little?
Yes, so currently, as the system lies, you have to have the Unionist First Minister or Deputy First Minister, and then a Nationalist First Minister or Deputy First Minister. The posts are equal in power. But because of that sectarian system that we operate under, there's no avenue for the Alliance Party to hold either of those offices, even if we were the first biggest party. And that's totally unfair that a cross-community party isn't allowed to represent the community.
So that's a big, big door knock for you. When you were going around the doors, Lewis, I mean, as an 18-year-old, people might have thought that you were helping the candidate, but you were indeed the candidate. Did you get a positive response? Were people taking you seriously and being kind to you and good to you?
Absolutely. The responses on the doors were generally very good. Of course, you'll have those people that were, "Oh, you're too young, close the door." But those were the people that were always going to be naturally hostile. But there was quite a large amount of people, a surprisingly large percentage of people on the doors who weren't going to vote. But then they saw this is a young person who's not like the other people that are already in. They're going to actually work and make change. And they then came out to vote and voted for me solely because of that. And that was a really, really positive, great thing that we'd seen in the doors.
Great. And what sort of demographic in terms of under 25s in your constituency would you be talking about?
So under 25s make up about 30% of the
Right.
council and the DEA. That's a rather substantial population. Of course, only 18 to 25 can vote in that category. I'd like it to be 16, but that's not a short-term goal.
Okay.
But the voter turnout for 18 to 24 is by far the lowest. I think it's mid-20% turnout compared to over 65, which is high in the 70s. And young people need to be turned out to vote because we're going to be affected by these decisions for by far the longest amount of time. And it's only fair that we have input and say in that decision-making process.
Yeah, it's so true. And voter registration and getting young people interested and curious about the political system and public service, broadly speaking, which is exactly what you. So you went into the councillors and you made a proposal fast and furiously to retain a Bible reading at the start of their monthly meetings. How did that go down?
So at the start of every 4-year term, we have an annual general meeting. Now, at the annual general meetings, that's the only time that the standing orders are allowed to be changed. That's where the prayers are at, the standing orders. So I made the proposal that the prayers were removed and replaced with a silent moment of reflection. Now, I did that because it's freedom of religion. One in four people in our borough, well, the Andrew and Abbey Borough don't claim to be Christian, that it's only fair that their government, that every single person pays into, is representative of everybody. And by having a silent moment of prayer, Christians can be respected, non-affiliated people can be respected, everybody can be respected. And that's just not the same under mandatory Christian Bible readings that we have at the moment.
And
So unfortunately, my proposal failed, but something I'd like to reintroduce in the future.
okay, well, I mean, it wasn't a massive margin, 22 for 17 votes if against and in favor. Okay, Lewis, your future is bright. It starts now. I think it's great for young people to have somebody like you leading the way. So good luck with it all. I wish you well.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you for your time this morning, Lewis Boyle, 18-year-old councillor, representing the Alliance Party in his local constituency there, Ballyclare in County Antrim. He's an alderman, as we say, rather than a councillor there. So good on him. It's 7 minutes to 10. Right, we're just at a little after 9:35 this Tuesday morning. I want to welcome two people to the studio this morning, Brendan Maher and Pauline Cullen. Good morning to you both. Lovely to see you.
Hi, Ryan.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for being here. What part of the country are you? I know where you're living now, but where are you from originally?
That's I am Kilkenny originally.
Kilkenny man?
Yeah.
And Pauline?
I'm from Athy, County Kildare.
So you're an Athy woman. Okay,
yes.
So not too far from you, and you're now living in Athy, is
yeah.
that
yes.
right, in Kildare?
That's right.
I love how you met. This is a good start to your story.
Yeah,
tell me about that.
A crowded chat room.
No, I haven't heard about a chat room for a long time. Tell me about that.
Yeah, no, I'll tell you. It was I was on holidays actually in Croatia at the time, and I sent Pauline a message. I think it had maybe been a week, and Pauline got back to me, and we just kind of had a bit of a chit chat for I'd say a couple of months, and then I was in between a few different things as well, and then we met up in May of 2016, and I was a bit all over the place, and Pauline was calling me odd for about 6 months because I was in between jobs and whatnot, and I couldn't settle, and then she kind of told me to, you know, what are you going to do? Are you in or are you out?
I'm thinking of the expression about a pot.
That's exactly what I was thinking.
Pauline, you might have used words to that effect.
I'm no spring chicken, Ryan, so I was kind of, I knew what I wanted at that stage in my life. And, you know, I just said, here, this is what I want if you don't want it.
What did you want?
I felt that I'd been single for a while and wanted to kind of meet somebody. And I knew I wanted kids as well, so Brendan was kind of...
On the pot.
On the pot still. But anyway, he wanted to travel. I'd done a lot of travelling.
Yeah.
Both of us love travelling anyway. Mm. So,
Did you feel you had done the travelling, the travelling you'd needed?
Well, I'll never be done with travelling, but okay. I felt
that
I would like to have kind of settled down. I had done a lot of travelling.
Yeah, and get on with the next bit.
Yeah,
So eventually, Brendan, you made your peace with the pot and decided it was time to do something. And and sure enough, you got together and here we are today.
Yeah.
And for living-wise, what were you doing as a job?
I was a nurse for years. I worked just down the road, actually, for a year and a half as well in Vincent's and Waterford Regional, and then I took on home care cases then for about 5.5 years as well. So, and then I left that, and jack of all trades, master of none since then.
We're all a bit that way. And Pauline, were you working as well?
I used to be an archaeologist for 15 years. And
wow, what an interesting job that is, too.
Yeah, it was great, but it wasn't very kind of reliable, I suppose, but I loved it. Great people I met and whatnot.
Did you work on digs around the
digs
place?
Digs, all follow nomadic lifestyle around the country.
And did that take you around the world or just in
Ireland? No, just Ireland, really. Yeah.
But what a fascinating job.
Yeah, so then during the recession, I went back to college to do social care, and now I work with special needs adults.
Okay, so I can see a simpatico in terms of where you're going in your worlds together.
Yeah. So
let's talk about then, you started your family, and we'll begin with Rory. He was born in May 2020. And let's start with the name Rory. Why did you call your son that name?
It was either Rory or Ferdia. We both love Irish names. And it's just when he was born, the little tuft of red hair came out and that was it. That was the obvious.
Yeah. Tell me about him when he was born and how your world changed as a result of becoming parents?
Well, I suppose Brendan worked in Kilkenny Hospital, and I felt when we got the diagnosis with the Harmony test, I was trying to kind of keep control of things and keep things normal. So I was saying, right, we'll go to the country hospital and we'll have him there. And we didn't know at that stage he'd heart problems.
And what is the Harmony test and when does it happen?
So
it can be done, Rory's done about 21 weeks, I think.
Yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah. No, 26 weeks, I think it was. I can't remember.
But
it's a test to show there's certain four things.
I suppose it picks up chromosomal abnormalities.
In the womb.
And Rory's came back. But before that, there are things called soft markers. One of them is a shortened femur, and Rory had it. So that was when it flagged initially, and that was when that was hard to say.
We were googling and googling and wishing. Wishing it wasn't, and then we got the result.
To say that your baby's going to...
He was Down syndrome. It's not a definite, it's a...
indicator?
High probability, which was 99.9%, I think, or 98%, I can't remember, but...
And tell me a little bit about, you said you wanted to have kids. You said you were no spring chicken, I noticed. That's an interesting way of putting it. Why did you say that?
Well, I'm older, and being an older mum, I had a fear of having a Down syndrome child because there's more of a possibility.
Okay.
So, and then the possibility happened, I suppose. We looked at the... One thing I always remember is looking at that little car seat and thinking about the child that you were going to have is not the child that you have now. It's, you grieve. There's a big grieving process
Yeah.
going through
I've heard that said before, and I try to understand it. I mean, in the sense that when you have the harmony test, you realize, okay, this is where your reality is going to be now. How did you manage that news together or individually?
I just remember I was doing fine that day, and I remember my sister rang that night and she really set me off. And it's nothing she said, it was just a nice sentence, a kind word, but I bawled.
Can I ask you what she said?
I can't remember, to be honest. Okay. Honest to God, yeah.
Yeah, but it was just something to reassure you, maybe. Yeah.
And
that was it.
The only one I could get reassurance, sorry, Bryn.
Was
my mum. She passed since, but I just felt she was the only person. She just said, you make it on with it, you'll be grand. And she was the only person kind of really that settled me.
Yeah.
Kind of, that was it.
And very stark advice, just look,
here it is. It was heartfelt.
What you wanted to hear. Okay, it was from a good place, obviously.
Yeah, it was.
So you came around as much as you could, and Rory came into the world.
Yeah.
How quickly was it apparent that, you know, it wasn't going to be a very straightforward shoot, if you like?
I'd say that evening, I remember the paediatrician was called up to Scapoo, special care baby unit from paediatrics, and he had heard a murmur, and I suppose it was in COVID as well, so we were only allowed in to see him for a few minutes at a time. And I remember I could see he hadn't piped oxygen on, or masked oxygen, but I could see he was struggling a little bit. And then they mentioned Crumlin and ambulance, and two days later he was transported up to the heart centre by ambulance and from Kilkenny. So
how old was he at this point?
Two and a half days old, I'd say. So that was when it all started then. He was in Crumlin for
three weeks.
Yeah.
He had pulmonary hypertension.
A condition called ASD, which is an atrial septal defect as well. And oddly enough, what we didn't know then and what we know now is that if you're going to get a heart condition, that's probably the one to get. The easier.
Yeah. Who wants any heart condition?
But
here you are.
Yes, yeah, so we've been through the ringer with heart conditions.
I can only imagine.
But, so Rory's, if we'd only known then what we know now, what we're going to go through with the next baby.
Let's focus with Rory for the moment in terms of the pain of having to go to Crumlin, the pain of having to you know, take a 2-day-old baby to a heart unit, if you like. You got him home eventually. Was it how long was it before you?
We got him home after 3 weeks, and then he was back in. He was back in 2 weeks later for a week, gastroenteritis. Then he was out. Then he was back in August for 5 days. Then he was out. Then he was back in October for another 5 days. Rory was diagnosed with chronic sleep apnea as well, so that they did a 5-day sleep study in Crumlin as well. And then he was set up in CPAP to be sent home on the CPAP machine and to help him at night.
Okay.
I'm sorry, being part parents, this is kind of the nature of being parents with heart babies.
This is
in
your
and
world.
Out, in and out, in and out, constantly. Yeah. And you kind of become a family of, because you meet all the other parents up there, so you're constantly...
It's a community.
You're meeting these people all the time, and we're always kind of looking out for each other. And there's always a face to see that you know between nurses, although sadly a lot of nurses that we know have gone. But we still see the same faces of nurses, some of the nurses up there from being up in the heart ward again.
And Rory today is, 3 years old?
Just gone three.
Three. A typical day for him? A typical night for you?
It's better. He's been discontinued off the CPAP, thankfully, since last November. So that's a huge help. But he was fed through a nasogastric tube up until he was a little over 2 years old, and then he had a PEG tube surgically inserted last July. That will stay in indefinitely until we can get him eating. So it's constant wound management with that. He's very low muscle tone all over systemically, but he's particularly in his solar plexus as well. So it causes the wound and the stoma to overgranulate. If he's any virus at all, it angers it, and then you could be changing that dressing 2, 3, 4 times a day. Sometimes.
On a lighter note, he
oh, yeah.
he wakes up. No, I'm not. He wakes up with a smile on his face, Ryan, and he always did. When you pick him up in the cot, he's still in a cot.
He's great.
He just wakes up smiling.
That's when the sun shines for
you.
Yeah,
he just shouts and roars.
Yeah.
One of us is trying to lie down with the other baby because you might have been up half the night, but you can't. We have a small house and you get up and he's very different to Fiacc, but he wakes up smiling.
I appreciate that, and I'm glad you mentioned that there is that joy as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, he's a huge joy. You walk down the town, my hometown of Pattaya, and he's like a celebrity.
Is he?
He knows everybody, supermarkets, library, our local library staff are like family to us at this stage, but supermarkets everywhere. He's just, he's a magnet.
Tell me, Brendan, about the decision to have another child and what drove that.
For me, oddly enough, if Brewery had been born neurotypical, I suppose, I may not have wanted one, but it's just the diagnosis of Down syndrome changed it. I just didn't want him on his own. And we were... You know, we asked a couple of the consultants and neonatologists and whatnot, you know, what's the probability of a second child with Down syndrome? And it's hard to label or give you a proper score on it. So, but I just wanted him to have a sibling, you know, just for me anyway, someone to look out for him. And particularly when the Harmony test for Fiacc came back, negative, we thought, yes.
Your second
low cost, it's a low possibility.
Low probability, so we thought, this is amazing.
We'll say yes, so you have then hopefully, your hope was to have a child who will be there for Rory when times are tough or whatever, or times are good, doesn't really matter, a sibling, simple as that.
Yeah.
The Harmony test you mentioned earlier comes back saying very unlikely any issues here. And then what?
Then bang, he came out like lightning. Both of my kids were supposed to be sectioned, but they came early, both of them, and they came the way they were supposed to come, I suppose. And yeah, we had him, and it was a completely different birth because we hadn't got those ideas of the Down syndrome. We knew he had a serious heart condition, and I had been attending the Coombe cardiology, the what's the name of that?
Franklin.
But I'd been attending there, so we got such a shock, I suppose, when our second child came out. We didn't know. I remember when he came out, we were full of joy. We were worried about that he had a more serious heart condition than Rory. But I remember one of the nurses said to me, "Has this baby been? Chromosomal test." Brendan said, I think you said he doesn't have Down syndrome. We had the test done. And I said, why are you asking that? And she said, because he's displaying features of Down syndrome. So the joy kind of got sucked out of the room fairly quick. It was just, we couldn't speak. We just looked at each other and, we got such a shock. But we kind of just had to...
You kick into just
get on with it. But
that he's well enough then and there, don't you?
Yeah,
you
know, I'm worried about it.
Physical condition at the time, you know, and because the heart condition was so severe. How severe at the time, we didn't know.
Back to Crumlin?
Back to
Crumlin.
Just remind me, Fiacc is how old now?
He'll be 8 months on Saturday.
And how long has he been, how many times has he been to Crumlin?
He was born in the Coombe, he was in the Coombe for a week, home for a week, in Crumlin for a week, home for 7 weeks, and then in Crumlin for over 4 months. Very, very sick. So sick, we were planning his funeral in February. That's how bad he was.
Sorry, that bad?
Yeah, yeah.
He was on life support for...
60 days.
60 days.
60 days.
And now, what?
He's doing great, Ryan. We kind of had a bit of a hiccup there. I went back to for a cardiology appointment with him and thought everything was going great, but... I was told then he'd need another surgery, so our world kind of fell apart again for another week because we thought it could be a possibility that he'd have to go into ICU, but he's going to hopefully have the lesser of
invasive
surgeries through cardiac. He's to have more heart surgery through a cardiac catheterization. Yeah. So in July, and Rory has PEG surgery. In July as well.
I'm trying to figure out how you two are functioning. honestly, one foot in front of the other. I'm trying to figure out how you're still talking to each other and not driving each other mad because...
Well that's hard.
Because it's a test.
It's such a test on our relationship.
Yeah. It must be.
Yeah.
The test as well because we were awarded a seven-week package because Tuke's on sleep app. He's sleep on a sleep apnea machine at night time, but that still hasn't kicked in. It's just a bit of a mess with the nursing situation in Ireland at the moment. And
is there a shortage of nurses?
Shortage of nurses, and
it's a system
right across. You can't get carers.
We've had five nights reprieve since we left the hospital, only through the good of Jack and Jill Foundation. Yeah. Mary Jo there is like, sorry, like a counsellor at this stage.
Well,
it's just an amazing charity.
That place is like a little garden of heaven, you know, in terms of what it does for people to give them a chance. Jack and Jill.
And then you have the Ronald McDonald House.
Yeah. Do you stay up there sometimes?
That was our second home when we were up there, but just to get a meal and the lovely staff behind the counter and people just chatting to you and talk to other families who are in a similar position. Yeah. And
it's an odd feeling. Like it's you know, you're part of this family you never, ever, ever thought you'd
know. But one of the things I suppose really, really wanted to talk about today was all of the help that we've been given.
If we could just play, Cleanas Foundation in Limerick was set up by a family, and they have been fantastic, because what's happening with the network disability teams at the minute, Ryan, are in absolute disarray. They're so short staffed. We're struggling for occupational therapists. We're struggling for SLTs, speech and language therapists.
Are they all going? Are they all emigrating, or are they just going into different jobs? Where is everyone?
It seems to be like there's not enough.
They're being pulled as well.
Not enough university places. And what the Department of Health have done, and I only found this out last week, is that the assessment of needs is a separate thing. This was up in the High Court. A couple of parents successfully went to the High Court because their children. I don't know, was it they're misdiagnosed or what?
But there's, it's an ongoing issue. I don't want to go down the rabbit hole, but I just was saying to you, but I appreciate where you're going with it. It's just trying to get a handle on it all.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you in the meantime, have... when was the last time you slept, a full night's sleep?
Two years ago,
yeah. No, I expected an answer like that. Brendan?
Together, it must be that long. Because
we share different beds, because one's on CPAP machine and the other one's...
has to stay with the babies.
And no breaks. You don't get a night away? No,
we don't really get breaks. The only break, it was when my mum's funeral, Brendan's sister took...
Rory
that
for
was
a night.
The first night I got away.
Hardly a cause.
No. 2 years ago. But on a happy note, my sister's coming back from New Zealand, the other sister, and she's meeting my children for the first time, so I can't wait for that.
You're great at finding that silver lining, Pauline. I admire you. I really do.
The GoFundMe. My friend Sharon sent up a GoFundMe page, and the love and the community spirit in Atai and Kilkenny, I can't get over it. Our little creche. Yeah. Set up a pyjama day for us, Sharon. Do you know, it's just...
Sponsored walks with a lady in Wicklow who we don't even know raised €600 for us in her cafe, and it's just, it's grown exponentially. It's been amazing.
It's a GoFundMe page you have as well? Do you know what, is it got a name, or can we guide people towards it?
Pauline Cullen and Brendan Maher, isn't it?
So it's your name is Brendan and Pauline, okay. You are getting married on Friday.
Yeah.
I don't know, what your lives. Like, why don't you move house while you're at it?
Depeche Mode tomorrow. It's my birthday on Thursday. My birthday, I'm a huge Depeche Mode fan.
So you're going to see Depeche Mode tomorrow. Thank God for that. I'm just glad you're going to have some joy or more. And equally, you're getting married on Friday. It's a registry office, very small. Yeah. Gathering, will you bring the boys to the registry office?
Yes, we are.
Will you get a night away to celebrate?
We're going to go to Carlo for the night, just somewhere near, so that we don't. If anything happens,
We can come back.
Well, Carlo's lovely too. I hope you're staying somewhere nice and.
We've got a big pig's back deal. That was it. We're not into fuss, Ryan. I get that.
Aisling has been on to say, I want to say a big hello. They are awesome. They're an awesome couple. Met them online and then in real life in Crumlin. Our Jack is in for a long time. You know Aisling McNiffin.
I want to mention her name,
couple and mum and dad.
She's been through the ringer. She's such a lovely lady.
She is, and she's a great advocate too.
Yeah. She's brilliant.
And I have to say, I'm looking forward to meeting. Are the boys outside?
Yes.
This is going to be great. I look forward to meeting them. And they're with Sharon, is that right?
Sharon and my friend Sinead.
So you've got a good bunch of people around you in terms of friends and family. And
Sharon is like my little HR lady these days.
She's doing all
she's
the administration.
She's great.
We have to leave it there. We could talk more, but I don't want to say, you know, you're extraordinary, because I think that's not what this is about. It's more... I just hope you get what you need.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying to you. Yeah. In terms of facilities and medical care, healthcare, yeah, and so forth.
Can I just mention, Ronnie, sorry, it's mammies like Ashley McNiff and another wonderful lady in me, the Tracy Carroll as well. Tracy has been her little girl, Willow. Tracy has to go into school with her. It's the only way Willow's going to get an education is Tracy goes in Monday to Friday and does it with her. And it's wonderful mothers like this who are championing the cause for their kids, and they're not going to go away. So I just hope the HSE will listen to them, you know. So
there are a lot of people who are unseen.
Yeah.
And they're good people. And I wish you every happiness. And I'm looking forward to meeting your boys now.
Thank you, Ryan. Yeah, thanks for having us.
No, thank you for coming in and telling your story. I really appreciate it.
A pleasure.
Good luck at Depeche Mode.
Yeah.
Don't go too mad. Good luck at the wedding. And mind yourselves.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Brendan Maher and Pauline Cullen.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Thanks,
back shortly.
Okay.
Text number is good to go for business on 51551, and emails welcome on ryan@rte.ie. And already they're coming in mostly about our dear friend Christy Dignam, who passed away, as you probably heard, yesterday, just 4 p.m. The news broke very swiftly after that. And while it was inevitable, it's never easy to hear about that, especially as somebody I think we all took under our wing as a friend of ours, as somebody we admired, as somebody we loved. I don't like to overstate the case about my friendship with people, particularly people who are well known and have achieved great things. But in the nature of the job, be it on TV in recent years, and then on radio all the time, because it was on radio that we did that interview with Christy in April, you do become friendly with people. And I remember, it must have been 10 years ago or what have you, and Christy was in, due to come in on the TV show for one of his many appearances, and he very kindly said I could come out and visit himself and Catherine in their home, where we had a lovely afternoon chatting, and about his beloved birds in the back garden, and about his father and his love of bel canto music and opera music. And It was a lovely afternoon. I remember going out to his house, because I remember at the time, I don't think my confidence was as great as it could have been. It was a tricky time for whatever reason. And I wanted to try and get under the skin of some of the guests that I wanted to meet. And Christy was one. And I really wanted to see him off campus and out of the milieu of Montrosia. And to be in his house like that, and for him and Catherine to let me come in through their front door, it's a big thing, you know, to go through over the threshold of someone's private domain like that. But we headed off, and himself and Catherine were a beautiful couple, actually, and a pleasure to meet. And Catherine remembers saying to me last in April, she said, I remember that time you called over. She said, everything wasn't quite right. And she was very astute, very, very smart. And she was right. We fixed things up, but it was a very, very, very smart observation. And I think herself and Christy had that. They could read people and read the room very well. And they came on the show together, actually, once upon a time. And it was lovely to see them like that, because normally Catherine would be kind of behind the scenes running the show, as we saw when I called out to the house with myself and Siobhan, the producer, and Damien on sound. And it was like the microphones weren't there, actually. It was very intimate. Christy had brought his bed, his hospital bed, if you will, downstairs, because he just didn't want to be in hospice care. He wanted to be at home. And I understand that. You know, if people are in palliative care, some people don't want to be in a palliative care setting. They want to be in the place that they love and know. And, you know, he was smoking away, still cut red during our interview. He said, I said, seriously? And he said, yeah, you know, like, you know where this is going. I said, well, I should look, whatever gets you through the day. And he conjured up that energy and that spirit that it's worth, if you didn't hear the interview, it's worth listening back, because he struck me as being a man who wasn't going to die soon. That's why I was quite shocked. I was going out, I prepared myself to see somebody heading towards the final few months of his life, and I saw a man who looked like he had years left. That was a very strange thing about that conversation. Very alive, very astute, very coherent, cogent, clear, and with great power of recall. And I spoke to Catherine, I'm sure, I hope she doesn't mind me saying, but we spoke afterwards on the phone, and she said, you know, he was the strongest he'd been in a long, long time in that interview. It was as if he was taking up, conjuring up that energy to say to you, to people listening to this show and beyond, you know, I want to say thank you. I want to tell you how important you were to me. I want to tell my family how important they were to me. And it was like he was trying to get the strength together to say what he needed to say before he said goodbye. And it was quite something. And after the interview, she said, Catherine said that, Christy, he kind of crumpled. It was like the boxer who fought that last big heavyweight fight. And he just went, whew, what was that? But he got there. And the love that came after that interview to us, to him, to their family, was, I hope, a wind in his sails as he heads to the next place. I really hope so. He contributed so much to the country, to the fabric of the culture of Ireland, and all those beautiful songs and all those great stories. God, I loved him. And I loved seeing him come through the door, and I loved talking to him. And I'm not as sad today as I thought I'd be, because I took strength from his strength in that room talking to him. I don't think he was afraid of death. I think he wanted more time, for sure. As he said himself, I was told 10 years ago, if I got 10 years, I'd be lucky. And I got 10 years. And now I want another 10. And who wouldn't? Who wouldn't? And he had a beautiful wife, as I say, Catherine. He had beautiful daughter, Kira. Kian, Ava, Jake, extended family, as Kira was posting yesterday. She said, Dad peacefully left us where he wanted to, at home. That's it. And today, 4 o'clock. Tuesday, June 13th, after a courageously long-fought battle. He was surrounded by his family. And we ask that you honour our family's need for privacy during this immensely painful period. Let us hold him in our hearts and cherish the remarkable life of a talented singer and a great storyteller, an amazing person. And, you know, we appreciate that because Kira and Darren, keeping the kids on the road and the show on the road there as the next generation, wishing them all our very, very best this morning. And thinking about your beloved granddad and your dad and your father-in-law and your husband, Catherine. And thank you for sharing him. Because a lot of people don't realise that when somebody's that big a deal in the world, they're shared. And the family have to put up with people pulling out of him when they go down to the shop or go for wherever they're going. It's all part of what they do. But we appreciate it because it was... he was an important man, that's for sure, and a wonderful man. I'm going to play a moment or two from the interview we did in April. And as we were sitting down in his house in Finglas, we were looking out the window, and I said to him, what do you miss? And he talked about, and this really stayed with me, he talked about a man walking by the street as he looked out the window, and he thought, God, to be that man. I thought, the simplicity. I don't know who that man was. He was probably going down to buy a loaf of bread, or he was heading to the bus stop and going to work, whatever he was doing. But I'm sure the man didn't realise we were looking out the window at him going, lucky guy. And it made me think how lucky we are. The arrogance of health. Sometimes you have to stop and say, I think I'm all right. I think I've got this. The man walking by the window.
I was sitting here one day and I was looking out the window. This was only about a couple of weeks ago. And this fella walked by the door. Just walking by, you know. And I just looked at him and I thought, you'll never do that again. You'll never walk, just go for a walk, you know. And then that kind of sent me into a spiral. I started to think all the things I won't do again.
You thought to yourself, I can never do what that man's doing, which is simply just walking by your window. Road, yeah.
Well, when I first got diagnosed, all I wanted was, I remember praying, there you go. I remember praying, please, just give me 10 more years, you know. Mm. And then 10 years are up now, and you're kind of saying, OK, I know I only asked for 10, but you couldn't throw another 10 in there, would you?
Who are you praying to?
I don't know. Well, you know, I had a friend, a Sioux Indian, and they just believed that each life was like a lesson to be learned. The more lessons you learned, the nearer you got to nirvana, until you became part of God, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that was the way. And I liked that kind of philosophy.
The point in our chat was about his happiest moment. And as we've been talking about his love for his family, it would come as no surprise when he answered straight away.
The happiest moment I ever had in my life was Kira being born. I'll never forget that moment because... And I remember thinking with Kira, this person existed, had no identity. It was just a bump on Catherine, do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And in a nanosecond, you'd kill everybody in the room if you tried to touch that baby, you know.
Yeah.
And I remember the love hit me that quickly, you know, and that suddenly. It nearly knocked me off my feet, nearly knocked me on my arse, do you know what I mean? But that was an amazing, feeling. And it's a little bit ironic that when I first got diagnosed, I remember thinking, I didn't care what car I drove. I didn't care where I lived. I didn't care about Aslan. I didn't care about fame. Well, I never did care about fame or any of that shit. The only thing I cared about was seeing my grandkids for a little bit longer, you know.
I'll play one more clip from that interview with Christy in his home in April. And that was when we talked about fame and fans. And he loved Ireland. He loved being Irish. That's the thing that we certainly chimed on. And here's some thoughts on that.
I'm still humbled by it, you know. Like, your reaction has been absolutely amazing. And that's another reason why I wanted to do this. I wanted this opportunity to thank all those people, because I never really got a chance to do it, to thank all those people who stood by me and who helped give me a great life. And it's been an absolute pleasure doing it with them, you know.
Incredible amount of love out there for you, I can tell you.
And I'll tell you another thing. If you ask me, would I rather be successful on a world stage and hated in Ireland or loved in Ireland and not give a shit about the international stage, I wouldn't swap it for anything in the world.
All right. Christy, it's hard, isn't it, to listen to that when you know that he died so recently, as yesterday at 4 p.m. But one of the memories that you'd have and that I have is sitting in that great chair in the Late Late Show and sitting beside Christy, and when he sings, there was something in the room changed, and the audiences would be leaning forward in their chairs, as would I, because he has a very distinctive voice and a great style about him. But when he sat down with Finbar Fury, something even more magical happened. Finbar, good morning to you.
Good morning, Roy.
I'm just thinking about that time that we sat together, yourself, myself and Christy, and it really was something, wasn't it?
It was a very special night. I always remember it. There was nothing like it, you know. I've never seen that like the pair of us. It was like he just came in, and it was, we didn't pick a key, we didn't pick anything, and he just opened up. We had a little chat first, and I just hit the chord on the banjo, and we took off with the song. And as I said, no rehearsal, no nothing, and it's a big song, you know. And his heart was totally in it, and I couldn't take my eyes off him, if you remember, you know, because the timing on it was, you know, the song he had, it, and he sang it from his heart. He always sang from his heart. He was very, 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 very gorgeous man, and did so much for music, you know, and the people loved him all over Ireland, everywhere I went, you know, they talk about Christy, and we were good friends. But the first time we got together, it was Janice Ryan put us together, Don Baker, Christy and myself, and we did a song called Wheels in Motion. It was on Gay Bourne, the Late Late Show. Mm-hmm. And I remember we sang that. It was for the Irish Wheelchair Association, and we were trying to get some money to send them to the Olympics. And Christy was all in, and Don Baker too. Don is a lovely man too. And the three of us just gelled. It was lovely that night. And when he walked in that night, when I was there, I remember Sharon was sitting in the corner waiting to do another song with me, and we were all tuned up to get into that. And then Christy walked in, and you know, it was just, we took off with he wanted to sing the Green Fairs of France. So in we went, and I was blown away with all of, you know, with just that. It'll never be done again. Like, it was just one of a very, very, as you said, a very special moment, you know. I was still seeing with his head thrown back there, and his heart out and just, he sang so beautiful that night. It was wonderful.
He had a great...
I remember the whole country was so excited about it, you know.
Yeah. It was one of the most viewed YouTube clips, yourself and Christy singing that song, I think, in all the years we were doing the Late Late Show, and because people were mesmerised by it. You both went somewhere else. Sometimes you can see performers come in and they do it, and they're doing their job, and they go. Sometimes performers come in and they lay bare their souls, and you guys did that night.
He I can't describe it to you. The feelings were like the hair stood in the back of my arms, you know. You know, when he sang and the two of us, the lovely gel in the song. I can't describe it. I'm sort of still half asleep here, you know.
Yeah.
So it's just a memory of his positivity, you know, with songs and music. And as you said there a few minutes ago about Ireland, he loved this country so much, you know.
Yeah, and he loved those songs that you do.
We had some great times together, you know. He was a very humble man too.
Yeah.
You know, like he would never put himself out there first, you know. And the two of us always, you know, we had that little, just a friendship between us and the love of music, you know, and the love of great songs. And he just floored the place that night. He was brilliant, you know.
Did you raise a glass to him last night?
I did. I went to, I was actually battled them out the way on the way back. I was in the studio yesterday.
Yeah.
When I heard the news, I pulled the car up and I couldn't believe it. And then when I got home, my family had told me that Christy had passed away. So the dinner was left on the table and I said, come on. I said, I have to go up. And I just went up to the local pub and had a pint and we just talked about Christy for the night, you know, and how lovely a man he was. He'd be badly, badly missed, you know. I know that he's got a lot of friends out there, and I'd say, you know, they're all, but everybody's missing Christy this morning, you know. Everybody loved him, and he had a great passion about people that he loved, you know, and people that he was, you know. He worked so that I never saw anybody to work as much, you know, as Christy. And I remember before the pandemic came in, we started to make an album together.
Yes.
He wanted to do an album of folk songs. And I think we got about four of them down, and then the pandemic came in, and, you know, that floored a lot of us for a while, you know. But I can't say only one thing about him. I loved him very much. He loved the music. I had great respect for what he did. And always will. It'll be in my memory forever, you know. And my family's member too. And all my son Martin was crazy about him, and young Finbar and all the whole family. And you know, Catherine is such a wonderful lady.
Yeah.
They're a great family. He'll be sadly, sadly, sadly missed. I miss him today so much, you know. Just I never got the chance to meet him before he passed away, and that was, you know, sad too. But he was one of these characters, you think that he was going to live forever, never, never. Everybody sort of said, ah, yeah, he's gone. You know, and then he wanted to come over and finish, do a few tracks, and we never got around to doing it. He was just too sick, you know.
Finbar,
very sad times.
It's good to talk to you always. It's sad today, but I loved what you said about Christy. I loved what you had with him. I look forward to those four tracks being produced and put together and released, because I know that that chemistry is you can only bottle that, and it's a rarity. So look, I'm wishing you and your family well today. Hopefully I'll see you soon.
Thank you. And our hearts goes out to Catherine and the family, you know.
Yeah.
And I think it's time to sort of give her a bit of a chance to get everything together.
You know? For sure.
His memory will live on forever, trust me. He was a beautiful man.
You're here. Well said. Thank you, Finbar. Appreciate that very much. Finbar Fury joining us live this morning. Another legend in himself, to be honest, but speaking beautifully about his friend and our friend, Christy Dignam, who passed away yesterday. And as he said about Catherine, and after Ciara did say, we like the privacy, and what I'll do is I'm going to play a piece of music and then I'll let the hair sit and let the family deal with their loss, and we'll talk about Christy again another time. But for now, there are countless texts coming in. Myself, my husband, says Trish, we cried into our dinner yesterday when we heard Christy had passed. He was such a part of our lives through music. I brought my husband a ticket to the Aslan in Connolly Hall in 1987. Our 25-year-old son also cried yesterday on hearing the news. He was such an influence in his music life too. So there were tears were out of love for the great Christy. May he rest in peace. And that from Cork fans and just it so many others. After your interview, we have talked about the man passing the window so many times, says a big Christy fan, may he rest in peace. And he spoke at length about his love for his wife, Catherine. And I saw firsthand and up close what an amazing person she is and what a support structure and system, a loving one, she provided for Christy. And that is why I'm going to play this song, which I know that Christy said to me he wanted played. in her honour, actually, more than anyone else's. So let's say, may he rest in peace, Suresh D. Gauravelam, to the great Christy Dean.
Yeah, we'll take some music in a little while, but I want to go straight to our guest this morning. James Comey, good morning and welcome.
Great to be with you. Thanks for having me on.
Not at all. We spoke briefly on Zoom to the TV show I was doing in the middle of COVID, and we spoke about your Irish connections and everything. I thought you might get a chance to get over here, but they wouldn't let you cross the Irish Sea, no?
No, that's exactly right. I was hoping I would as well. But I'm sorry, this is a poor substitute for visiting the beautiful place.
Let's talk about what you've been up to, because you've written a book called Central Park West, and it's a novel. You've of course written a couple of books that are non-fiction, but this is a completely different world. Why don't you? We've got lots of places to go this morning, James. But let's begin with the synopsis of the book and give us a flavour of it, and then we'll get stuck in.
Yeah, sure. Thank you. It's based in Manhattan, and it tells the story of a federal prosecutor for the U.S. Department of Justice named Nora Carlton, my protagonist, who is handling a mob case and not paying attention to a case involving the murder of a former governor that's being prosecuted in state court just down the block. But those two cases slam together in ways she never expected. And so it's about the journey that takes her on, along with her sidekick, who's her investigator named Benny Dugan. And it's the story of those people and takes the readers inside what those cases are really like, because I did those kind of cases.
That's right. So you were the state attorney in New York, and you know these courtrooms. In fact, and your daughter continues to know these courtrooms. Tell us a little bit about, you know, even courtroom 318, a significant place in your life.
Yeah, 318 is a courtroom, a grand courtroom in the old federal courthouse in Lower Manhattan. And it was the place in which my great friend Patrick Fitzgerald and I prosecuted John and Joe Gambino, two major mobsters, for 6 months when my oldest daughter, Maureen, was a little girl. She was 4 years old. And when I was working on this book, she was in the same courtroom, now a grown woman and the chief of the Violent and Organized Crime Unit, in the same office in which I had worked. And she was on her feet in that same courtroom in a weird crossover of life, prosecuting Ghislaine Maxwell, Jeffrey Epstein's partner in abusing a lot of young girls. And so the protagonist had to be a woman, and I named her Nora so as not to embarrass my daughter too much, but she's inspired by my daughter Maureen and my other daughters, and I use her as the vehicle to tell the story.
I think it's really important to make that point, that because you're the proud father of four daughters. So if you didn't put in smart female protagonists in your novel, you probably would be disinvited for Thanksgiving next year.
I think that's right. And the advantage of it being a compilation of all four daughters is if any one of them doesn't like some part of the character, I can say it's based on your sister.
Good one. Good one. And I wonder, are your daughters kind of thumbing through it going, that's me, that's her, that's me, that's the other one? I mean, is that the kind of filial feedback you've been getting?
Yes, they went through it very carefully in draft. And among other things, my oldest Maureen pointed out that I had put her office on the wrong floor, so I adjusted that. But I think overall they're happy with the portrayal. Their father did not embarrass them.
Well, speaking of, can you remind us what height you are, James?
I am 6'8" tall.
And when you, as a proud dad, want to stand discreetly in the back of the courtroom to see how Maureen is getting on in prosecuting the bad guys, how do you achieve that, or is it possible?
It's funny you should say that, because she forbid me to come to the Maxwell trial in courtroom 318, telling me, if you come, Dad, quote, it'll be a thing, which I think she means a bad thing. And so I couldn't go. My much more normal height wife went and gave me the reports from there. I've gotten a chance to watch Maureen in action, and I kind of slip in the back and try and sit in one of the rear benches.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure you have some class of disguise, and COVID might have helped, in fact, with the mask in some way, going some way to mitigate for everything. Let's talk about your wife, if I may, briefly, Patrice. She is critical to the genesis of your book. I don't know if there's probably a series, I've no doubt, but tell us about her role in terms of conception, and ideas-wise, and then execution of the plan.
Well, she's the idea person, so it's her responsibility to come up with ideas for a story and to pitch a story line. And she has great story vision, and she's read a tremendous amount of fiction and crime fiction. So I couldn't do it without her. And then my job is to agree upon that vision and then go off and write it. And then every day get feedback on a Google Doc from her, which is easier to get when it's remotely, because it's not as painful to me. But then I make adjustments based on that feedback, and then the next day do it again and again and again until it's ready to be read by all of my children.
And if you were to be handed those notes and and be in the same room as your wife, would that have caused some friction in your marriage, do you think?
No, I think it'd just be more painful for me. Everyone has a different relationship, but I go through a process where when I'm corrected on something, I initially deny that she's right, and then my next step is to think she may be right, and then the final step is, of course she's right, and it's better if I can go through that process privately. It's less painful.
And can I ask you what your wife does for a living?
She is works with foster children. She's trained as a marriage and family therapist.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of work to help kids in distress.
Okay. And as a family therapist, I suppose she can on occasion bring her work home with her to deal with all of you.
Yeah, she's. I always tell people she didn't become a therapist because of me, but it's been very beneficial.
Did you, when you were involved with the as a state attorney and then later in the FBI, did you find yourself not wanting to read books and related matter to what your job, or were you tempted to dip into crime thrillers and what have you, or did you let that just leave Patrice to all of that?
I. Not intentionally, but because I found it so hard to think about that in my spare time, my days were filled with crime and terrorism and espionage. It was very hard to watch television programs or read about it, not because authors got it wrong, but because I just wanted to get away from it. And so I just before I became a prosecutor in 1987, I read the crime thriller by Scott Turow, Presumed Innocent. Mm-hmm. And I really wasn't able to get back to that work for 30 years, probably. And so it was after getting fired in 2017 that the farther I got from the work, the easier it became to think about it and then to write about it. And the distance is what made the difference.
And who did you kind of gravitate towards when you were maybe doing a little research or trying to find your groove for writing Central Park West?
I started by reading John le Carré's work. Mm-hmm. I think I read all Le Carré's books, both because he's a legend in the field and also because I gather he had struggled with how to make the fiction accurate but also exciting. And could he actually hold readers' attention if he depicted it, the spy business, the way he really found it? Because I wanted to tell the actual story about how it works, not make things up except making up characters, but having the procedures be the way they really are. And I've tried to do that, and I think it holds the excitement. I haven't had people, I haven't been fantastical in the way I've depicted these cases, because you don't need to be exciting.
Your grandfather was a cop, was he?
Yeah, he was. A child of Irish immigrants. He became dropped out of school in the sixth grade to support his family when his dad was killed in an industrial accident in New York, and then he became a police officer and became the leader of the Yonkers, New York Police Department.
Right. Classic Irish trajectory, I mean, to join the police force like that. And then when you were a young boy, you and your brother James were at home when a burglar broke into your house. Can you give us a bit of detail of what happened that evening?
Yeah. When I was a senior in high school,
yeah,
there was a robber and rapist who the press had dubbed the Ramsey rapist, a serial attacker, kicked in the front door of my parents' one-story home in New Jersey. And the police said, apparently looking for my sister, who thank God wasn't there, and found me and my brother and held us captive that night and threatened to kill us, and we escaped. And then he said he was going to kill us again, and we escaped again. It was a wild and terrifying night. And had left a lasting impression on me, as you might imagine.
You were what age were you at that point, James? And for how long
I was 17, so I was senior in high school,
okay,
last year before university.
What did that do to you in the short term?
You know, I'm an unreliable narrator about myself, I think, but at least consciously, it didn't steer me into law enforcement, although it seems obvious now, given my family and that experience. But it made me grow up in a lot of ways very, very quickly. And when I became an investigator and a prosecutor, it made me much, much better at understanding the pain of victims, because I had only gone through a very small piece of what women who were sexually assaulted by this guy experienced, but I could feel enough of that pain that it made me better at my job.
You also have strong thoughts, as most right-minded people do, about bullies. Were you bullied as a youngster? I mean, we've talked about your height. Maybe that was a factor, but what was happening in that regard?
I was. Especially because we moved from Yonkers, New York, to just across the Hudson River when I was a kid, and I thought I was moving to another country, and I stuck out. I had a bit of a New York accent that the New Jersey kids didn't, and I had very big feet and a very big mouth, but not a big body at that point in my life, and so I would always have some clever quip that the bullies were confused by and probably infuriated by, and so I dealt with a lot of it during my grade school years. And that's something that stayed with me. I've always thought of, like, the mafia as among the biggest bullies there are, and I took a lot of satisfaction in putting those bullies away.
The mafia families that you were dealing with were, how would you describe them? Because I know you've talked in the past about the Godfather film and the effect that might have even had, and the book, obviously, might have had on a certain generation of mafioso families. And how once upon a time they might have been discreet in their violence, and then they became more effete, if you like, more peacockery with it all. Talk to me a little bit about that, and what drove you to, you've alluded to a little bit, but what drove you to really go for it and take them down?
So the New York Italian organized crime, La Cosa Nostra, the five families, were really shaped by art in an odd way, because the U.S. Mafia stopped inducting new members in 1957 because the bosses of the major families thought they were losing control of who was getting in. And they didn't take any new members again until 1975, when at that point each of the five families could make 10 members. And so what that meant was from 1957 to 1975, there was an entire generation of really bad people who could not get on the inside. Well, The Godfather landed in 1972 in the States and shaped those people, because The Godfather wasn't, in many ways it was accurate, but in many ways it depicted La Cosa Nostra in a way different from reality. But the mobsters who couldn't get it on the inside saw the movie and thought, in fact, one of them explained to me, he remembered the day he walked out of the theater and he said, the light hit my face on 18th Avenue in Brooklyn, and I thought, that's the life. Mm. And so they started talking that way and imitating the dress and the cadence of those characters. And then when they were finally able to get into the mafia, those Hollywood-shaped hoodlums reshaped Cosa Nostra and its culture a bit and made it much more prominent. But, you know, John Gotti used to wear $5,000 suits and march up and down the street and get his hair cut every day. And that they were shaped by Hollywood. And, of course, what successive mobsters have realized is that's really dumb, because you stand up and down in a $5,000 suit and get your hair cut every day, the FBI is going to put your picture at the top of a bulletin board and your future is going to be limited. And so over the last 10, 20 years, they've gotten much more clever and realized that fame is a recipe for a long jail sentence.
It's like you're describing, to keep the movie analogy going, the transition from The Godfather to Goodfellas, which of course was... You know,
yes.
they became, as you say, ostentatious with it. And what was it like for you to confront these guys in the courtroom? And were you confident you could take them down? And the feeling of ultimately listening to verdicts being read out?
It was surreal to deal with these characters in a courtroom, because they really do tell themselves that they're a uomo d'onore, a man of honor, and that they live by a code. And of course, it's all nonsense. I mean, the code is broken as often as it's followed, but they they try to convince themselves and you as the prosecutor that we are both noble warriors just on different sides. And so there's a certain honor to the conflict. And look, I didn't mind that because that meant they weren't going to try to kill me. They saw me as a honorable opponent. So there was that weird dance, but seemed almost oddly civilized in the courtroom. Mm. I had a mafia hitman once pass me a note congratulating me on receiving an honor from the New York City Bar Association and saying that he read of it and it's well-deserved and signing his name. And that's insane because I was trying to put him in jail for the rest of his life. The presenting the case is very difficult especially against the high-level mobsters, because it turns on getting other really bad people to become witnesses to testify against, up the chain, against senior people. And that's a dangerous dance because obviously using criminals to get criminals risks the integrity of the prosecution, because these senior mobsters are only alive because they're wily and have become really good liars, frankly. And so using them in the pursuit of justice is a fraught enterprise. But look, it's very, very satisfying because these people, although glorified in a lot of our media, even in a Goodfellas, which shows the darker side better than The Godfather, these people are people who just terrorized innocent people. They're the bullies that made you walk a different way in the schoolyard on the scale of a city. And so honest business people trying to run a butcher shop or trying to run a carpentry business are terrified by these people. And to relieve that burden from those people is what made it fulfilling to be a prosecutor.
When you got to the top of the FBI, James Comey, how did that make you feel? I'm thinking of the young lad who was mocked at school, or the young fella who was, you know, held at gunpoint by the Ramsey rapist. Now you hit the top. Tell me about that achievement for you as a son, as a father, as a brother.
It was both a thrill and a source of the imposter complex, feeling like, what am I doing here? A kid who used to wear white socks with black shoes and get mocked for it. And so I think that's a healthy balance, that I was both excited to be there and wondered why on earth President Obama would want me to do it. But I loved the work, and the best part of the work was the people of that organization, who are just fundamentally good people trying to do something to serve their country and to help protect innocent people. I loved being with them, but I never quite lost that sense. When I would walk into a room and they would stand up when I came in, I'd think, why are they standing up? It's just me. But they were standing up for the role. And once I realized that, some of the discomfort went away. It wasn't about me. It was about their respect for the hierarchy reflected in the director's office.
And when Barack Obama called you in and said, I just want to have a quick conversation with you before you got the nod, did he call you in for that first time to say congratulations, or do you think he wanted to look in the whites of your eyes?
I think probably a little bit looking me in the whites of my eyes to get to know me better. And also I think he did, enjoyed our first conversation, and he knew that once he nominated me to be the FBI director, he would never speak to me again personally.
Okay.
Because it's been a tradition in America for the last 50 years, as a result of some of the excesses of the first 50 years of the FBI when J. Edgar Hoover led the organization. It's been along the tradition that presidents keep a certain distance from FBI directors so that the FBI doesn't become political. It's apart from the political power in the presidency. And so President Obama was explicit about that and said, once I name you, you and I will never speak like this again. And I just wanted to talk to you. And so we just talked like two people in a pub might talk about all kinds of things. And then at the end, he said, well, okay, good luck. And then we never had a personal conversation like that again.
Amazing. And even your description of the job as being depoliticized, and you know where I'm going to go next, obviously, because you mean you became a complete target of hate, and I presume much worse, by both the left and the right. The left said, because of the investigation into the Clinton emails, that directly led to the election of Donald Trump, and the right said, well, you know, you were chasing the Trump presidency or Trump campaign about Russian involvement and so on. Take us to the eye of that storm. Where did you find solace, and how challenging was it for you intellectually and emotionally?
Yeah, it certainly was a storm, but oddly at the center of it, the fact that both the right and the left thought you were on the other side's team, which is crazy because we weren't on anybody's team, but the fact that you were getting both wings of the passionate American political spectrum angry at you was freeing in a way, that you knew that no matter what you did, you were going to be criticized. And it may sound odd to your listeners to hear that, but there's something freeing in that. It's like being the referee. You know that the crowd's going to yell at you no matter what you do, so just do your job. Also, being surrounded by people at the Bureau who were the kind of people I described was also helped make the center calm, both in a larger sense and literally. One of the pieces of the FBI that people don't realize is that there's this culture where the tenser things get, the quieter and calmer everyone speaks. Mm. And so someone can come in and give you horrible news, and the FBI culture would say, you respond not by saying, oh my God, you say more.
Okay.
Very quietly like that. And so there's this sense that we are culturally calm, we are apart from politics, we are alone, and there's a certain security in that. And look, the way I dealt with it was just make sure don't we read Twitter comments, try not to have the window of hate open too wide, and also just spending time with my family, making sure I get exercise and sleep, and hugging my children and my wife just is a way to step away from the craziness. But look, it was not easy, but sometimes it's not as hard as, for the reasons I said, as people may think from the outside.
And where were you on election night?
I was home and went to sleep. Again, because the nature of the FBI, the job, has lots of other aspects that aren't obvious to the public, and it requires regular sleep. And so I thought, well, okay, I'm going to bed. And so I'm a pretty disciplined person, so I was able to sleep through the night.
And the next morning?
The next morning, I'm forgetting when they called the election. I think I woke up and my wife told me that they'd called the election for Donald Trump. And my reaction was, okay, I hope to God we had no role in that outcome, in affecting that outcome. It doesn't change how I think about the decisions we had to make. But I pray that we weren't an impact on the election, and we'll just go forward and do the best we can.
And are you reading from the book of Edith Piaf? Is it Je ne regrette rien? Is that where you're coming from on all of it?
Your French is better than mine. But
no,
yeah.
No regrets, you know.
I have deep regrets about being involved. I really don't think about the key decisions differently, even after reflecting on it 1,000 times and talking about it 1,000 times. Mm. I think we faced an impossible decision tree. There were two doors. They both led to hell. And we chose the least bad option of what faced us. And I still think that even after all this time.
Are you in terms of the next election? It looks like we're in the twilight zone, and it's going to be Trump Biden. Any thoughts?
Yeah, and not just Trump Biden, but a twice indicted, maybe more than that before the next election, and we could really have the. I mean, it sounds crazy to say if you put this in a script or a book proposal, it would get rejected as fantastical and ridiculous. But we could have a president subject to a term of incarceration, a presidential candidate at the time he's running for office. It looks like on the current course and speed, the Republicans will remain crazy enough to nominate Donald Trump, and he's in a world of trouble criminally. I've read the indictment in the classified documents case, but it looks like we're going to rerun the election, but rerun it with all kinds of more, it seems impossible, but more complications around Donald Trump.
It it's flummoxing, to say the least, but that's what's coming down the tracks. James, we have to leave it there. I've thoroughly enjoyed our conversation. I hope we do it again sometime. Congratulations on your entry into the fiction market with Central Park West. Appreciate your time this morning and wish you well.
Great to be with you. I hope to do it again.
Yep, here, here. Okay, James Comey, former head of the FBI and now novelist, joining us live this morning from London, England. His book is called Central Park West, and I think fans of crime and, I suppose, police procedure, really, in court drama will enjoy that no end. Okay, James Comey, live this morning at 10 to 10. At 9:24, Killian Donnelly, welcome home, welcome back, and welcome to our studio. Good
Thank
to see you.
Thank you so much. It's good to see you, Ryan.
You're looking very cash and summery. So you did cycle in the end. I wasn't joking.
Did cycle in. I'm loving all the new cycle lanes that they're building in Dublin.
I think that did it kick off during COVID. They started encouraging people to get back on their bikes and things like that.
I think it did. I used to cycle to Phantom over in London, and it would take me about 45 minutes to an hour. So when I was over here, I was like, right, I really want to start cycling again. And there's new cycle lanes, so I got from Artane all the way to here in about 35 minutes.
Not bad going.
Yeah, really good. Really love it.
Safe?
Safe, really
That's
safe.
That's the key.
Yeah, and I noticed the same cyclists. So we're doing all the nods. Morning, how
yes.
are you? We're getting all that, so I love it.
I don't wear the gear if whenever I'm on I do wear the gear.
Yeah, I do the cycle shorts, so which has padding in the bum.
Okay.
So that's to all you cyclists out there, get the padding in the bum because it really helps on some of the roads. And yeah, it's great. It's
I won't
great
be wearing those because I think the country has suffered enough. But I appreciate that you're going to do that. And you know, as I say, could you imagine? The country just resigns. Okay, let's talk about you and life broadly speaking, because when you said that you cycled to Phantom, it wasn't Phantom FM. You were talking, of course, about your role in London. We'll get there in a second. I want to talk about your out-of-tune piano when you were a kid.
Yeah.
In the front room with half a guitar. It's amazing because for books, I always say you should take the Hansel and Gretel approach to books for kids. Just leave them knocking around the place and they'll trip over them and they go, what's this? As opposed to forcing them down. Equally with you, you had this piano and a guitar. Talk to me about that room and the guitar and everything
else.
Yeah,
well, we were never really told to stop singing in our house. If you were humming a tune or anything, it was always encouraged, and my mom would always go for the harmony above,
nice.
Be it anything. But we had a front room which had a out-of-tune piano and one guitar, and we called it the music room. So you were just allowed to sing out and do anything. My father sang, my mother sang, my brother and sister sang. And I think in our village of Kilmessan, everyone thought at Christmas time we were like the Von Trapps around Christmas, all gathered around the piano. But we loved a session. We loved a sing song. And yeah, that's where my love for it grew. And then I discover musicals through my dad, through my mom. And that was really where I started building singing musicals, trying to learn them on the piano, trying to learn six chords on the piano, trying to match that to a guitar. And I just got lost in that room for hours and hours and hours singing, blasting music.
We share a few things in common. One of them is the importance of Colin Wilkinson to our dads, actually.
Yeah.
Because in my house, there was the vinyl of the show tunes. It was the lovely, greatest bits of the
Stage of Heroes. Stage Heroes.
That's the one. Amazing selection of songs. And you got that. Now I'm talking vinyl, but you had it on CD.
I had it on CD. I'd always sort of slag my dad about the people he'd listen to and the voices he'd hear.
Yeah.
And now I love them, the John Denvers and the Vince Gills. And he goes, right, you want a voice? Here's a voice. And he handed me Colin Wilkinson, Stage Heroes. And he just said to me, track 7.
That's it.
And he walked away. And track 7 was Bring Him Home.
So that's
I remember it, 11 years old, hearing that voice. Yeah. And I played it over and over and over and over. And it was just the beginning for me. It just changed everything where I went, what is this song? What is it in? My mom would say, that's a show called Les Miserables.
Yeah.
And it was like, I was like learning all about it. And it wasn't until I got into the show, Les Mis, in about 2007, that I went to see the show before I got into rehearsals, a week before. And then you see where Bring 'Em Home is
and
in
the
that
arc.
Show.
Yeah.
And the arc and how it exists in the character and... Yeah, I'd only heard it at sing songs, at sessions at 4 o'clock in the morning, people
it's
singing it.
It's a very hard song to sing, I suspect, and because it covers a multitude of ranges. And it begins off, you know, when it begins off, that lovely music at the beginning, that gentle...
So the beautiful story that I have is I did Valjean in the West End, And it was like the 32nd year.
This is the head, the this lead, is lead Les role Mis, in Les Mis, Jean Valjean.
Jean Valjean, yeah, in the 32nd year, written by Claude-Michel Schoenberg and Alain Boublil, and they came to the birthday. So we all go front of house and we all are given champagne and hugs and pictures. And Claude-Michel comes up to me and he goes, great show, well done, Killian. And I go, look, I'll probably never get this opportunity. Can you tell me a wonderful Colin Wilkinson story? He's my hero. And he goes, yep, love telling this story of how we created Bring Him Home for that man. And we were performing in the Barbican. We were performing Les Mis in the Barbican before it went to the Palace. And we had 7 weeks there and I hadn't written Bring Him Home. And Cameron McIntosh was coming up to me going, have you got the 11 o'clock number for our star, for our hero Valjean? He goes, I have it. I hadn't got it. I walked by Colin Wilkinson's dressing room and he was singing quietly The Phantom of the Opera because he was learning the demos for The Phantom of the Opera because he was going to be performing that workshop for Andrew Lloyd Webber. So his voice was The Phantom very quietly. And he said, I haven't heard that part of Colm's voice. I'll write a song. And he wrote Bring Him Home in G, I think. And Colm said, bring it up. And he brought it up a key. Bring it up. No. Brought it up another key. And it went up to A. So that's the famous story that he told.
Illustrate that for me in song, if you can, that arc of that tune. So it began where, roughly
it began,
speaking?
It began,
and I'm catching on the hop
no,
here.
No, 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 it began. So it would have been a God on high. But Colm had this part of his voice that he wanted to explore. And also, it's a prayer. It's sung in the barricade when everyone is asleep. And it's meant to be a silent. The song is called The Prayer in the Show when you get the script. It's not called Bring Him Home. So he's singing a prayer to God asking for protection over Marius. And it has to be sung quietly. It has to be sung like a lullaby. So Colm just found this part of his voice and it would be God on. And he was like, it's actually more comfortable if you bring it up. God on. It's actually more bring it up. God on high. And then the orchestra just kicks in and everything. So yeah, Hugh Jackman tells a great story where he's
hang
like,
hang on. Sorry, I'm still... The way you so effortlessly illustrate that story with that high tone.
I cycled in. I'm warmed up.
I'm telling you, those bicycle shorts, I might rethink this. If it means I'm going to be talented, I might rethink this. So go to that high place again and just give us two lines of it because it's so immaculate.
God on high, hear my prayer. In my need, you have always been there.
Wow. That is breathtaking.
Oh, thank you.
This is why I wanted you in studio this morning to share you with everyone your talent for people who haven't seen you because
thank you.
God, that is some skill you have there.
He did it. It's all Colm and I was doing the 25th concert of Les Misérables at the O2 and Colm walked in front of 600 actors. And we all gave him a big round of applause. Yeah. And I was just amongst them sort of going, he's Irish. He's one of me. Yeah. I should go up and say hello to him. And he was leaning on a staircase backstage with a bottle of water and just went, Colm, hi, I'm Killian. I'm from Ireland. And he gave me a big hug.
Did he?
And he went, how are you getting on? Tell me everything. And it was just, he was so proud and yet never knew me, but like to get into the show.
But isn't it amazing that, so from Colm to yourself, that you should become the kind of kings of the West End of these high-end, high-powered performances. The two Irish guys, you know, flying the flag. I always say that about you, flying the flag proudly in the West End. It is extraordinary. For all the talent that they have in Britain and what have you, or around the world, that you guys landed these iconic roles.
I will never forget when I auditioned for Valjean and Cameron McIntosh was in the auditorium and I was on the stage and I sung a song and then he said, the Irish belong in Les Misérables. There's something in the water.
Is that right?
Yeah, and I just remember it really stuck with me. And there's been many Irish people in Les Misérables, but it's amazing where one of the greatest musical theatre songs ever written was written for an Irishman.
Who was in his dressing room working on another musical when the writers heard a register and said, I need to go there. Wow.
It's amazing.
That is amazing. Let's talk about Les Mis for a second, because when you're in that, what is that the role you want to play, Jean Valjean?
Yeah, Jean Valjean.
You don't want to be Javert sometimes, the baddie.
You kind of do.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun playing a baddie sometimes.
You kind of do, because when you're in the show, to talk to people about it, yes, you want to be Valjean, but when you're in the show, Valjean is on for an hour and 46 of a 3-hour show, where Javert is on for something like 27 minutes.
Yeah, as most baddies generally are. Most baddies are. Don't get as much seen.
And you, when you're offered Jesus and Jesus Christ Superstar, you want to be Judas. It's always you want to be the other one.
Let's go there. Because again, I'm showing my kind of albums in the home collection. And yeah, one of them was Jesus Christ Superstar. And the original cast, Ted Neely, yeah, and that sort of thing. But that the opening bars of Heaven on My Mind, that my mind is clear, and isn't it? But it's just that thing, and then when he starts going, my mind is clear, and that interpretation,
and then he gets to the Jesus, the scream where it's pitched. It's not singing; it's a scream. Yeah. It's a roar,
and then goes into full waka waka. You started to believe the thing they say of you. And it's great fun though. It's funky soundtrack, regardless of your religion or lack of. It's just fun. Have you played any of those roles?
No, yet? I was in an amateur production of it.
Where, and who'd you play there?
Everyone. I was told I played the 13th apostle because they needed men for the show. And we all got the text and too many of us showed up. So I was told, Killian, don't worry, you'll be in it. And I was like the waiter at the Last Supper, just dropping things down and coming in. But it was that. It was that moment where you hear that score, something hits you. And it was written as an album, as a concept album.
Yeah,
it was never
like
written for a musical.
Wasn't that?
No. And then someone approached Andrew Lloyd Webber and said, this is a musical. We can do something with this. And it's just become the phenomenon that it is. And these.
It's dark.
It's dark.
Yeah,
it's
so dark. When he's talking to God and he said to his father, you know, I only want to say, if there is a way, take this cup away from me, because I don't want to taste this poison. Like, it's that sort of intensity. It's quite poetic.
Yeah, it's beautiful. And I've seen it. It was one of the first shows that I saw on the Amdram circuit in my home musical society. And it was one of those things where it's like, what is this?
Yeah.
When you're 11 or 12 and you're seeing these, you're going, this is a thing? Yeah. Musicals? What are these?
You also touched on something there, Killian, which was the shortage of men in Amdram and musical productions. Like, if you were a man looking for a partner, female partner,
get into musicals.
Get into musicals.
Get into musicals, lads.
This comes up again.
Stop playing football. Get into musicals.
If you're lonely, don't go on the...
You don't have to dance. You don't have to sing.
You don't need an app.
No, you don't.
That's what the musicals should recruit men by saying that. You don't need an app. Just
get
up.
Into musicals.
Let's talk about your wife, Louise, because you met her at one point and it wasn't the right point, and then things changed. So what was that first point?
That first point was Louise was already in London doing the circuit. She was in We Will Rock You and Singing in the Rain. And I saw her in We Will Rock You, but we had mutual friends and never had met. Mm-hmm. So sort of mutual friends put us in contact through like Facebook or something. And, oh, can I come and see your show? Can I come and see your show? And she denies this, but I asked her out over the 15 years, I asked her out about 3 times, but she would go, absolutely, I'll meet you for a coffee, but just so you know, I am with someone.
So she denied you 3. This is biblical now.
Absolutely. Here we go. Jesus Christ Superstar. Yeah. Denied me 3 times. Right? So I'm currently writing the musical. And then it took me to get Valjean in the UK and Ireland tour there in 2018.
Yeah.
And we went to Dublin for 6 weeks across Christmas.
God, the things people will do for love.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Louise was in Dublin at the time, so she came to see me. And then that same mutual friend said, look, just so you know, Louise is now single. I went, right, okay. Yeah. So I gave the performance of my life and I went up to her afterwards and she was like, well done. And she'll always play it cool. Yeah. And I was like, can we go for a coffee? Can we just... So the rest is history.
And
I
you had been Valjean. Is that what you said?
Yeah. So in order to get my wife, I had to get Valjean in Les Miserables. So lads, join musicals.
Join musicals and you'll meet the love of your life. It's a neat narrative, isn't it?
Yeah,
that worked out.
It's beautiful.
I've asked you this before, but do want to ask again about, say, Phantom, for example. So how long did you play the West End most recently?
18 months. So I was given a year's contract and then I was allowed to stay for another 6 months. And then it was like, right, I'll pop home. So it was 18 months.
18 months.
West End.
And is that finished now?
That's finished park.
For
I
now.
Guess when you work for Cameron's, you're never really gone. The
you're
door's
on the books
open.
Or you're in the stable, as it were.
I guess it was that thing. If I get Valjean and Phantom under my belt, I can be a Valjean and Phantom for
whenever.
World.
Okay, so like Colm Wilkinson in Toronto and where he spent so much time. How many times a week in those 18 months were you playing Phantom?
8 times a week.
And that's...
The 8 shows a week, the full 8 shows.
Which is 5 nights.
Six nights. 6 nights, 2 matinees.
That's Wednesday and Saturday.
Wednesday and Saturday, yeah.
Okay. Tell me how you maintain an interest in the same
songs and notes day in, day out, sometimes twice daily, without wanting to rip the mask off and run to McDonald's and just order a Happy Meal?
Excellent question. And it's the people you work with. Every show has a 3-month honeymoon period.
Okay, interesting.
And then when you get into that 4th month, you're like, okay, now I'm just putting on the clothes. And I think I've said to you before, there have been times that I've been singing Bring 'Em Home on the West End, thinking of when's the Tesco shop arriving.
Oh, no.
Is it 3 or 4?
It's terrible when you're not engaged. Yes, yeah.
But understudies and swings that are in the show.
Now, what are swings?
Well, I started as a swing in Les Mis, and my job wasn't you're going to play this one role for the next 12 months. It was you're going to cover these 10 roles for the next 12 months. So I had 10 roles to learn, 10 roles to play. Yeah. And in a 12-month contract, there's 4 weeks holidays, there's sick days, so people will be off. And you would be playing different roles. Once a week, you'd probably go through about 3 or 4 roles. So mm-hmm. you learnt on the job. It was the best training I could have ever asked for.
Okay.
So when you're Phantom, you've got 4 different alternate Christines to work with. So your Christine Daae could be sick, and then the first cover goes on, or the second cover.
And what does that do to your performance?
It changes the entire show.
Wow, okay.
Because I'll say, there are some actors who go, this is my, this is how I do it, and you've got to work around me. Where I go, look, I know the show, and yeah. I know my track of where I have to go. Let's do your show. So I'm able to guide you if you're an understudy and you've never been on before. I can help you in scenes. The one thing was helping into the boat, because the actor would go off stage right, and I go, no, we got to get in the boat now. So it's like, oh, the boat.
The boat. Don't forget the
Can't
boat.
Can't do Phantom without the boat.
Okay.
So it changes the entire show.
Yeah.
And that for me is like suddenly 12 months go by and it's done. After 6 months is when they're sort of saying, do you want to stay for another year?
Yeah.
So then you realise, are we already halfway through?
Yeah.
And coming back to Phantom, it was similar to Les Mis. You're always doing things with Phantom. You're 3 months in and suddenly they go, so you're now singing at the Queen's Jubilee.
Oh, I see. So before you know it, you're doing
So you're off next Saturday and you have to go down to Buckingham Palace for a dress rehearsal, and then you're on the Sunday. And all those things happen because it's the Phantom in the Phantom of the Opera. When you're a Val John in Les Mis, someone like you, of course, will know who I'm talking about. But a lot of the general public go, oh, I've heard of Les Mis and Val John.
Hugh Jackman, is it? Yeah,
exactly. But when you say I'm Phantom,
it's
a culture icon. And so they know immediately. So he's everywhere. They want him to open everything. The Tesco's.
The Tesco's you were thinking about. I must do that opening of Tesco's next week. The mask, the iconic mask that Phantom wears. But before I ask you where it's gone, putting it on for the first time, for example, was that a buzz?
Yes, absolutely. There's a guy,
especially in the West End, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah. And they make 6 masks for you. And what used to happen was you went to, I've forgotten his name, but you used to go to the makeup artist who did The Elephant Man. You used to go to his house for the weekend and he'd pour the mold over you and you'd have straws out your nose and your mouth. Now it's all done with a laptop and they fire a light into your face and then this 4D cast comes out and they make it on your face. So they make 6 masks for you and you have your 2 favourites throughout the 12 months of a run because it's a nice pair of shoes it just sits on. So yes, the first time it got onto me, I was like, wow, because there's there's prosthetics underneath your face. You're in the chair for 2 hours getting all that stuff on and then they pop the mask on. I've been lucky to do a few characters, but a lot of people and actors I'll work with, they go, I need to get into the costume before I feel the character.
Oh.
And I've never been
You've
like
never
that.
Felt like that.
Never
that,
been like that. Until Phantom.
Oh.
Because when you're doing a tech rehearsal and you're in your shorts and flip-flops and t-shirt, I was like, I need to feel sexy. I need
Phantom-y.
To feel Phantom-y.
Well, or menacing and creepy.
Menacing and
you
creepy.
You say sexy, but I mean, I've seen Phantom the Opera.
I played it sexy.
He's a creep looking through a two-way mirror. Let's face it. I mean,
100%.
How he has been cancelled.
100%.
Cancel the Phantom.
We always talked about this.
You?
We were teching the mirror. And I was like, is this weird to anyone else? Like,
yes.
I'm just standing watching her sing.
We seem to just constantly roll with it, going, oh, there's the Phantom looking through a two-way mirror. Wait a minute.
Absolutely.
You weirdo.
Yeah. Come down to my lair. I've got a boat. I'll sing you a few tunes on the organ. You'll love it.
Come on, Christine. We can do this. Christine. Yeah, bring the mace. That's the Phantom I want to say. By the way, how did you get those injuries, Phantom? Oh, it was a bottle of mace. That's the alternative Phantom.
That's the sequel.
We should write that. Who knew?
Phantom of the Mace.
Oh, yeah. I want to go and see that. Okay, Phantom of the Mace. God help. How do we get here?
I don't know.
Let's keep going.
I love it.
Let's keep going.
Join musicals, lads. Join musicals.
You'll have crack and you'll meet somebody important in your life. What was the song of songs in Phantom that you loved to sing that you never got tired of?
Oh, Music of the Night. There are these songs that are just written that, like, Michael Crawford originated it, and what he did, where he walked and how he hit notes in certain places. It just
really?
It just sits well. Andrew Lloyd Webber loves to write in D flat. And D flat, I
found... What does
found,
that sound like? I'm going to put you on the spot if you can. Are you talking about Music of the Night?
Yes.
So do you want to give us a couple of lines from it? And then to get into character, do you want a two-way mirror and a pan of mace? Sorry.
Yes.
I mean, if you want to get into character.
D flat. I did a workshop with him, and I remember another person said, "You love to write in D flat." And he goes, "D flat is the most romantic chord ever."
Lovely, okay.
And he goes, "I wrote a lot of Phantom in D flat." And I just found by singing Phantom, it sits so well in my voice. Where I mean, nighttime sharpens, heightens each sensation. Darkness stirs and wakes imagination. Silently the senses abandon their defences. So very similar.
Take it to the,
very similar.
Take it to the finish of the...
Senses.
Help me make the music of the night.
Important to hit the T.
The T.
Otherwise, you're really Irish and you're coming out Music of the Night.
Or Music of the Night.
Music of the Night.
Like that could be in the Phantom of the Mace. It's the Music of the Night.
The biggest note I ever got in Les Mis was I kept saying beneath. And it was like beneath. Valjean at one point has to say beneath to the bishop. And my director was coming up to me and goes, "You're constantly sounding Irish. You're going beneath." Yeah. And I was like, "Well, we say TH like a th." And, and like fifth. All these things. And he was like, "No, just stop." And I was so true. I heard a recording of myself and I was like, "Beneath." And then one night I was like, "Beneath."
Oh, yeah.
So Irish.
So what's correct? Beneath.
Beneath.
Beneath. Okay. Let us talk about... Ryan, I think Killian was going to talk about the Hugh Jackman story about Colm. We did get caught lost in that.
No, part. Hugh Jackman tells a great story where we were on set. I was lucky to do the Les Mis movie and he sang Bring Him Home. The day he sang Bring Him Home, he did it 16 times in a row. And I remember after take 7 or 8, he was drinking his water and we were all there asleep on the barricade. And you just heard him go, "Colm Wilkinson, man, he could have done it so much lower." It was just
higher. Colm tells that story when he's on stage about reaching that note and trying to get there. Okay, let's get some texts. Mary is on from Dublin. 10, you're talking my language this morning. My favourite musical of all time is Les Mis. I've seen it numerous times and have a copy of the original tape from 1985. Enjoying your chat with Killian, says Gareth in Dunleary, and you're absolutely right about the societies. It's a long-running joke in my own group that DMDS actually stands for Dunleary Matchmaking and Dating Society. The group celebrated 60th birthday this year and is responsible for countless weddings and babies. That's good.
Amazing.
You can't hide the talent, says the text. When you're good, you're good. And Killian is good. Great to hear Killian Donnelly on the air this morning, says another. Musical theatre enthusiast, self-described, especially as over 1,400 members of the AIMS, that's the Association of Irish Musical Societies, are on the road to Killarney at the moment for the AIMS weekend, celebrating all of the wonderful amateur musical societies throughout the length and breadth of the country who help nurture musical theatre in Ireland and also provide a platform for stars like Killian to progress to the professional scene. So thank you, Killian, for being an inspiring performer.
Oh, thank you. Have a great weekend.
Somebody else, "I'm crying in the kitchen. The music of Les Mis is so special." Mm. I mean, you talk about bring him home. It's a very moving piece of music, and to call it the prayer makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the sort of thing you'd hear at, you know, maybe somebody's funeral and what have you, because it's just, it's sometimes some
songs are just pure emotion.
Absolutely. Yeah, it just really connects. It reminds a lot of people of that certain someone. And it's the lyrics itself. If I die, let me die. Let him live. Yeah. Bring him home. Bring him home. It's the one moment in the show where every single character in Les Mis is asking God, when they address the audience, which every single solo, I Dreamed a Dream, On My Own, Stars, they are looking at the audience. Yeah. And the secret they tell you is the audience is the face of God. The audience is God. So you're asking the audience, you're asking God.
So it's very plaintive.
But Bring 'Em Home is the only song where you tell God, you demand something from God. So it's sung very quietly and lovely, but apparently it's you have to demand and shout and scream and need it.
As a dub recently moved to Kilmessan, says a text, it's lovely to hear Killian's story. My six-year-old son is in the village choir, one of only two boys. He will love to know that someone from Kilmessan is such a musical superstar.
There you go. That's where I started, in Kilmessan choir.
That's where it all began.
Yep.
Let's see where you're at. You're at Fun Home in the Gate Theatre. People can go and see you there in live and in glorious Technicolor in real life. July 6th to August 26th, gatetheatre.ie. I am not familiar with Fun Home, so give us the crash course on that, please.
I was on Broadway doing Kinky Boots, and everyone was telling, in 2015, everyone was saying, you have to get a ticket to Fun Home. And it was across the road, and I went to see it knowing nothing about it. And that was the best thing.
It was a graphic novel, was it?
It was a graphic novel by Alison Bechdel, and it's her real life story. So who we're playing actually existed. I play her father, Bruce Bechdel. Her father was a closeted gay man, father of three. Alison was an openly gay lesbian, and she was a cartoonist. And it's her story from when her father, the 4 months when she came out in her college years to when her father killed herself, and the secrets that
He died by suicide.
And the 4 months, the whole show tracks the 4 months over the secrets that she uncovers about her father.
Okay.
And it can sound heavy, and there's a lot of trauma, and there's a lot of, but she wrote it as a comic. She wrote it as a cartoon, a tragic comic is what she described it. So it's actually a comedy drama set to music by Janine Tesori. And
intriguing, I have to say.
Well, it cleaned up at the Tonys in 2015, won Best Musical, and it was on Broadway for a limited season. It had the UK premiere in the West End, and now this is the Irish premiere. Okay. So it's to be involved with something like that at the Gate, and it's a small cast. It's meant to be an intimate piece, but it stuck with me for a few weeks because it was the songs and just the emotional impact it had.
Sounds wonderful. I'm definitely going to get along. I've in my post-late life, I want to embrace theatre a lot more. So I'll go to the Gate and see you there, which sounds great. Gatetheatre.ie. Killian starred in a Cork Opera House years ago when I worked there. I think it was Peter Pan. I remember saying then, that guy has the special sauce. And I was right. Well said. And Ivan McKenna was on. I say hello to Killian for me. Tell him it's going really well. He says he'll remember from that from the shows we did years ago.
Yeah, we did a Hot Mikado years ago on the Amdram circuit. And Simon Delaney actually directed it. And I was given a line, it's going really well, Ivan. And still to this day, I can't walk down the street or at Ames without someone going, it's going really well, Ivan.
Well, let's face it. What a note on which to leave our most enjoyable chat this morning. It's going really well, Killian. Fair play. I'm delighted for you. You've got a young son, Tig.
We've got Tig, a 3-year-old, and I'll give you an exclusive. My wife is 26 weeks pregnant with number two.
Go on. I'm so happy to hear that. Yeah. Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
That's such a lovely, lovely story. I'm delighted for the 3.5 of you. And here's to the quartet being completed.
Exactly.
All right, Killian, absolute joy to talk to you. Continued success. Keep flying the flag and enjoying life. And thank you for being here today.
Thank you so much, Ryan. Thanks for your support.
Killian Donnelly joining us live in studio today. It's 8 minutes to 10.